Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Since 2003, the StoryCorps organization has been recording and archiving conversations. Each interview is preserved at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. If you've heard even one of the stories, you've likely experienced how carefully they get to the heart of the matter. Last year, the StoryCorps team visited the Pacific Northwest for a project called Finding Our Way. In partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Seattle University, and local homeless service providers, they recorded conversations concerning homelessness. The Gates Foundation recently hosted an event featuring three stories from the project. Participants were joined by StoryCorps staff and Seattle area leaders working to address homelessness. KUOW's Bill Radke moderated their discussion about what our community is doing and should do about the homeless crisis. This Finding Our Way event took place on May 19, 2015 at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitor Center. Project sponsors included the YWCAs of Seattle, King, and Snohomish counties, Catholic Community Services of Tacoma, and Seattle University's Center for Strategic Communications. Thanks to Kevin Mitchum for our recording.
Hello, everyone. Hi. Oh, it's great. It's a friendly crowd already. I can feel it. My name's Colin Min. I'm a senior program officer here at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it's my great honor to welcome you all to the Visitor Center for tonight's event. I'd also like to extend a welcome to the visitors who are watching on the live feed all the way in the Visitor Center Theater. So welcome to all of you. I guess I should look at the camera. Welcome to all of you. Thank you. Like to hear it. Many first-time visitors to the Visitor Center here at the Gates Foundation aren't aware of the fact that we actually have a regular series of adult programming. And tonight's event is actually one of those features. If you'd like to find out more about the regular programming that we offer to the community to talk about issues that we care about, there's lots of information around, and you can find representatives from the Visitor Center. We'd love to see you here at future events. Tonight's event is actually a co-production along with KUOW, StoryCorps, FireSteel, and Seattle University. So I'd like us all to give a big round of applause for our community partners. This entire series also would not be possible without incredible collaboration from the YWCA as well as Catholic Community Services in lining up these interviews. So thanks to both of those organizations for your work. So I was just thinking a little bit about how much has changed since we launched this initiative over a year ago, kind of early 2014. You know, it really doesn't seem that long ago, but as I started thinking about it, I realized that, you know, a lot has changed. I mean, Bertha was still drilling when we got started. The Seahawks were still Super Bowl champions. You know, it was a happier, simpler time back then. But perhaps most relevant to our work today is that StoryCorps had not yet won the $1 million TED Prize that they went on to win earlier this year. And for those of you who haven't heard about the TED Prize, you can go to storycorps.me is the website, and you can learn all about an incredible app that you can download on your phones that allow you to conduct StoryCorps interviews with your loved ones right at home. It's really an amazing, amazing app. It's an amazing recognition of the tremendous work that StoryCorps does. And so I'd like to encourage you all to check that out. And at the time, we certainly didn't know what this project was going to turn into. You know, we knew through this grant that we wanted to give voice to the thousands of people whose lives have been affected by family homelessness in the Puget Sound region. But we really had no idea how wildly successful this initiative would be. Through the StoryCorps interview process, more than 100 interviews have been conducted. More than 200 people actually participated in those interviews. And all of those interviews will be made available to people who want to help spread the word to really point out to the rest of the community that family homelessness is a real experience in our communities, and that we really need to do something to prioritize these issues, because I think, you know, we all recognize that in 2015, in the United States of America, the richest country in the world, the richest country in human history, the idea that families, you know, that children are sleeping outside in the dead of winter, that's absurd and unacceptable. And we all need to do something about it. And really, tonight's event is an effort to try to keep the conversation going, to raise the profile of these issues. And so what we hope that we can do is, by profiling just three of the more than 100 interviews that were conducted, to give you a little sense of the issues that are at play, and most importantly, to inform you about how so many members of our community are trying to improve the situation, and also what you can do about it. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand the mic over to Eve Claxton from StoryCorps, who will get us going. So thank you so much, and welcome.
Hey, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? I have a little softer voice, I think, than Colin. So thank you, Colin, for that great introduction and for spearheading this initiative. And as Colin mentioned, this was a year-long project. I am just one of a very large team of people who are involved in making these recordings. StoryCorps is a project that's been around for about 10 years now, a little more than 10 years. And the idea behind the project is that we record stories of everyday people from all walks of life all across the country. And we record these as conversations between people who know one another. And what we do with those recordings is we archive them in the Library of Congress, and then a small number of them also get shared on National Public Radio and our local affiliates, such as KUOW. So that's just a little bit of background about StoryCorps, but over the course of the last year, we've come out to Seattle numerous times with a focus on voices of as Colin said, people who've been affected by family homelessness. And many of them are here in this audience tonight, people who recorded with us. And I just want to say what a privilege it's been to have you be part of this project and to be there for your recordings with you. And I'm going to tear up if I look at you directly, but know that I carry you all in my hearts. And every recording that we made was just so special and so... I think what I took away from the experience was just... the incredible resilience of the human spirit and how open-hearted people can be when you ask them to share their experiences with you in this way. So thank you, all of you. And I want to share, as we've mentioned, just three of the many, many stories that were recorded. And the first of these we recorded in Tukwila, Washington. It's a story from a local high school there. The story begins 3 years ago when Lika and her family were evicted from their housing. And at the time, Lika was 14 years old and was in eighth grade. She's now a junior at Foster High School in Tukwila, Washington, and she's here with us this evening, and we're going to ask her to come up in 1 minute after we play her story. This isn't the first time that Lika will be sharing her story. She actually first shared her story in front of her fellow students during Foster's homecoming assembly about a year ago. Yeah. And in this StoryCorps recording that you're going to hear, she's talking with her teacher and advisor, Miss Lynette Finau, about what it's like to attend high school and middle school while living in a homeless shelter. Thank you.
I would walk the school hallways with my head down. I felt embarrassed because here I am coming to school and knowing that after school I didn't have a home. My best friend, she kept asking me when can she come and sleep over and stuff. Like, I made up an excuse. I just told her my parents are strict to hide the real truth.
I remember, Lika, when I learned that your family was homeless. And to be honest with you, I was surprised because usually, you know, students who are homeless, their physical appearance will reveal a little bit of their situation. But the way you carried yourself and the way you dressed, I had no suspicions at all. What inspired you to tell your story to the school in front of the whole student body?
I basically just wanted to speak up for those who struggle in school. I was a homeless student, and I had to think about my actions and the effort that I had to put in order to succeed. And I thought maybe I can just tell them about what I went through and how hard I'm pushing myself.
I was embarrassed to go to school every single day knowing I was a homeless girl.
You captured everybody's attention in that gym, adults and all the students.
Thank you.
Before I sat down, I started getting hugs. And this girl, she was running down the bleachers and she ran straight to me and she thanked me for what I said. And she said, I'm going through the same thing as you. Now that everyone knows, I could just keep my head high. And I'm more willing to open up to people because I don't have to hide anything. Like, there's no burden inside of me.
Because of your courage to share your story, your teachers are reaching out to you. The counselors are reaching out to you even more. And so I'm a better teacher now because I look at every student with the assumption, what if they're like Lika? So I appreciate you, Lika, for what you have done, and I have so much faith in you.
Thank you.
That was Lika and her teacher and advisor, Ms. Finau, and I'd love to invite Lika and Ms. Finau up onto the stage now, but I also want to acknowledge Lily, who is Lika's incredible mother, for raising the most phenomenal and courageous daughter. Thank you, Lily. And after we play each story, we're just going to have a little opportunity to talk with, I'm going to be talking with the participants. And Lika, I guess my first question to you is, can you let people know here how your family are doing now and where you're up to?
I'm sorry.
Please take your time. It's very emotional hearing yourself like that. And it's very, very courageous what you're doing, coming here tonight and talking to all of us. Would you like me to ask Ms. Finau first, and then I can come back
yes,
to you?
Yes, please.
Okay. Ms. Finau, thank you so much for being here tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, you know, this is not a unique story in the community that you work with at the high school that you're at. And can you share a little bit about that and maybe any advice you might have for your fellow educators of how to support families who are in situations like Lika's?
Well, as you know, Lika and I are from the Tukwila School District. We are our high school, Foster High School, is only about 5 minutes to the airport. And as a new teacher there, I really wasn't aware of the student population and the poverty level in this district. And when I met Lika and listened to her story for the first time, it was then, which was just last year, it was then that I realized that this was really going on, that it was a common occurrence with the students in this district. In fact, just last night, I sent an email to the superintendent and the principal to send me the data on homelessness and students that fall under the McKinney-Vento. Most of you are familiar with that, just in our district alone. And I was quite astonished when I saw the numbers. Just the historical data from 2009 to 2015. Just 2009 to 2010, there was only 48 students that fall under this category, homelessness. And today, 2014, 2015, as of now, there's 330. Now, it's a very small district. It's only one high school, one middle school, and three elementary school, but still the number 330, that's 11.2% of the students in this district that fall under this category.
And just our high school, there's only one high school, just our high school alone, there's 88 students. And that is 10.6% of the students in the high school fall under the category of homelessness. And I am so grateful for Lika and her courage to come out with her story. I was very, very overprotective of it, and I have to admit that I did not want her to share her story at the assembly because I was afraid that even her teacher, her English teacher, I didn't understand what the intention was for her to share the story at this multicultural assembly. I kind of took it as maybe they were trying to exploit her story. You know what I mean? And when you're sharing it in front of a student body of 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th graders, I just didn't know what kind of response coming from this student population. And but Lika kept saying, "Ms. Finau, I really, really feel that I need to do this." And so I said, "Okay." And she did, and here we are. And she is a great leader for that. And she has become very transparent about her experiences. And she's not ashamed of it because it has really changed many of us teachers, and I'm one of them. And as a teacher, we need to sometimes listen to our students. And it has changed, of course, as she said, as she mentioned, a lot of the students, too, who are hiding behind this to come out and share their story and know that there are resources out there to help.
And, you know, thank you so much, Ms. Finau. And we met Lika through Reverend Jan Bolajak, who's here this evening. And when Jan went to Lika, this was something that she put her hand up for and wanted to do this and nominated herself to do. And from the minute I met Lika, I was just so impressed with her strength and how she really sees herself as a spokesperson for others who are in a similar situation. Lika, do you want to tell us a little bit about where you're up to now? You're a junior in high school and your family are doing great. And do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. sorry. Thank you. Yes, I'm a junior at Foster High School. We're still struggling a little bit. We still live in the house that was donated by our church. Just two bedrooms. My mom's still continuing to find housing for us because we really want to get out of there. But right now we're still strong. And we're truly blessed to still have this roof underneath our heads. And I'm just so thankful for everyone who continues to support me and my family. Yeah, that's all I can say.
Lika, thank you so much. And what you've done today and what you did in your recording and what you did at your school assembly, I don't think there's many people who have your strength and have your heart and your intelligence. I think everyone who meets you is just so impressed by that. And I want to thank you for being here and for making your recording and for sharing it with everyone. We truly appreciate it. And thank you so much, Ms. Finau, for your words. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to come down from my perch. Okay, so we're going to hear from our second story for the evening. You're going to be hearing from Alina Rogers, who's also here with us tonight. And back in 2013, Alina was homeless with her two young boys. At that time, she'd made multiple applications to local landlords, but her past substance abuse problems and criminal history meant that every landlord turned her down. During her search, Alina learned about the Landlord Liaison Project. This is a program that encourages landlords to use alternative criteria when screening homeless families. And in return, landlords receive ongoing support and advice from the project. Alina came to StoryCorps to talk to her current landlord, Raj Kumar, who's also here with us. And you're going to be hearing from Alina about how she and Raj first met and how she introduced him to the Landlord Liaison Project. Thanks.
I was looking through Craigslist. I was homeless with my two boys, and I saw your listing, and I just sent an email from there.
For me, that was a little unusual email that I received from you.
I think I just told you everything.
Yes, you did.
Because I was frustrated with searching and being rejected and thought the only way I can do this was just to lay it all out there. Here's my challenges. But this is what I've done since, that I had gone to drug and alcohol treatment. I had gone back to school, and here's the Landlord Liaison Project that's willing to stand by me and would you please give me a chance?
I was a landlord for almost a year by that time, and I had never seen or approved somebody like that. I wasn't sure, but then I thought about it. I Googled Landlord Liaison Program, and I said, okay, you know, let's meet first. You see the apartment, talk about it. I just wanted to try it out.
I wasn't sure what to expect, but I could see that you were very willing to hear me out, and that gave me a lot of comfort.
I've been there in your place. We lost our home when I was about 16 years old. We had a lot of debt. So to clear that, we had to sell our house. Mm. So when I met you, I liked you as a person. I didn't see anything that would stop us from, you know, moving forward. Mm-hmm. I have really good experience with you. You're always communicative. You pay your rent on time. It makes my job easier.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is if you had any awareness of what you've done for my family. You allowing us to have a stable home changed everything. Now I'm in graduate school and my son's going to go to college. We're just not stressed anymore and we're happy. And that's just been a huge thing for us.
I can definitely say with the, you know, the progress I have seen in your life, you have come a long way.
Thank you.
Just taking that chance for a landlord sometime is worth it.
Okay, so that was Alina Rogers and Raj Kumar. And Alina, Raj, will you come up? Thank you so much, guys, for sharing your story and coming here tonight. So my first question is for Alina. Now, Alina, when you came to your recording, how well did you know Raj, and what sort of transpired in the recording that you found out as you had that conversation?
Well, the interesting thing about our interview is that our relationship was landlord and tenant, so I really never had any opportunity to get him to know Raj on a personal level. And so through that interview, I'd already had a lot of respect for Raj, but I had learned so much about him. And I think it was neat to have that perspective, the background on things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell me about what you're up to now, Alina. Where are you up to in your life and what's going on with you?
Okay. So I have been in permanent housing for, I believe in June, it'll be 2 years. In that time, I finished my undergrad degree. I got licensed through the state of Washington to be a drug and alcohol counselor. And then I've entered a graduate program at Antioch University in the couples and family therapy program. So my youngest son is going to start kindergarten, and hopefully he'll be able to stay in one school since we have that stability. And my oldest son, he ventured off to college and came back because he changed his mind a little bit. But we're finding a new program for him, and things are just going a lot more smoothly now.
And how much is that due to the stable housing? I mean, obviously there are many factors in play, but how's that factor play into
it? It's a huge factor. Right when I sent that desperate email to Raj, like, please, I'm on paper, I'm a total mess, but I promise I'll be a good tenant if you just give me a chance. My sons and I had lived in a shelter. I spent some time on the streets due to my addiction. And then my sons and I, we were living in a shelter, and we finished out a program there. And then we moved into transitional housing where we were for a couple of years, and I still wasn't able to find any housing. I could not find housing. Nobody would rent to me. And so when the transitional housing time came to an end, I was 24 hours from being in my car with my boys. And luckily somebody heard that I was having this struggle, and they had a garage. And that's where my sons and I were. And so I was getting really frustrated because it was like, I've done so much. You know, I've really made resolutions with my past and moved forward and gone to school, but I'm still homeless. And I was about to drop out of college because I kind of felt like I couldn't work two jobs and go to college. So I was going to quit college and pick up another job so I could. I thought maybe I would have to buy a house was the only way I was going to get into a home of my own. And then my son was thinking about stopping. He was doing Running Start during all of this. So my son was a homeless high school student, and he's doing Running Start through all this. And he's thinking about not going to college because he's thinking he needs to stay home and help the family. And so things weren't going very well at that time. But everything happened right, I think, when it needed to. And Raj answered my email.
It's amazing. Raj, tell me, from your perspective, what was it like being in the interview and learning things that you learned about Alina?
Sure. Yeah, for me, same thing. After the initial conversations we had and she started renting with me, I didn't have a lot of communication with her except for landlord-tenant communication. So that was first opportunity for me to learn a lot about how her and her family's lives were changed. Every time she talks about it, she makes it look like I did something big, but for me it was a routine work, and I was happy to meet her and hear her story. I felt comfortable, so I just decided to rent it to her. I talk a little bit about in my piece that why it's personal for me, because in Lika's age we lost a home. I lost my mother that time. And I was embarrassed. I would sleep on a train station opposed to going to my relatives and be embarrassed. So I just determined that time that, you know, I'm going to do something, and if I'm in a position to help people, I would like to do so. So for me, it was a perfect opportunity to see, you know, she was on the verge of changing her life, and I just wanted to help her out.
Mm-hmm. And now, since your positive experience with Alina, you've gotten more involved in the Landlord Liaison Project. Can you talk about what happened since renting to Alina?
Sure. First of all, thanks to Alina for introducing me to the program, and thanks for Landlord Liaison Project to allow me to be part of it. After having good experience with Alina, I had three more families come through the program, and every time I have a unit open, I talk to them first and see if there is a family that is looking for accommodation. As landlords, we have to make sure that the rent is paid on time, but we have no problem filling the apartments. I personally look for a family who is on the verge of changing or doing something big, and it can help them in a big way, because I'm not worried about the rent. I think a lot about after talking to her over the recording, that what would have been her life and her family's life if we didn't meet and we didn't go through this and she didn't have this apartment. She would have probably kept going like that, and So I just don't even think about it, but then you get to stop and think like how it helped her, and it really is a good and proud feeling when I know that.
Thank you so much. Thank you to both of you. And it just still amazes me that of all the landlords that you could have sent that email to, you managed to find Raj. It's really incredible. And since then, Raj has rented to three other families through the formerly homeless families through the Landlord Liaison Project. So thank you, both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so this is going to be our last story of the evening. I'm going to introduce you to Charlotte Wheelock and her husband, Nick Hodges. They moved to Seattle in 2014 after Charlotte was offered a job here. Soon after arriving, however, the job fell through and Nick became sick with spinal stenosis. This is a condition that left him paralyzed from the waist down. They were no longer able to afford a place to live, and so Charlotte and her two boys, who were then aged 6 and 4, began sleeping in their car in the hospital parking lot while Nick was being treated inside the hospital. And Charlotte and Nick came and recorded with us to talk about this time in their lives. So we're going to hear from their recording first and then have them up on the stage.
I definitely remember sleeping in the car while you're in the emergency room and the kids have passed out in the back seat. I would barely sleep at night because I was watching for security guards or I was making sure that, you know, we were safe and keeping an eye out.
When you guys would visit me in the hospital, it's just like a sense of relief because I know that you guys are going to be safe for a few hours with me. And I could try to give you a few minutes to try to pull your thoughts together.
You would take over and the kids would climb up into bed with you and start watching cartoons. And I would just go in the restroom and cry because that was the only time that I had 5 minutes to myself to be me and not have to be mom and not have to be brave for you. And I could just fall apart.
It's a very thin line to walk when you're trying to be normal for your kids, but inside your head, you're scared to death.
You had gotten out of the hospital. We found out the news that there was a spot open in the family shelter. Even though I knew it was going to be this huge opportunity and relief for the three of us, it wasn't going to be easy for you. It meant sleeping on the floor and no privacy and out the door at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I knew you were in pain still and uncomfortable.
It was tough at first, but I just felt good to be with you guys again and to know that we were doing it together and you weren't just by yourself trying to do everything.
Someone had mentioned that they were opening a new apartment for families and their rent was 30% of your income. So I was really excited because heaven forbid you have to go back to the hospital again. I wanted to be in a position where I could afford to pay rent by myself if I have to. Of the 10 open apartments that they had, we got one.
It was just like so many doubts and worries just gone within a few seconds of hearing, yes, come get your keys. I remember just moving our stuff in on the first day the kids were still in school and daycare.
And we locked
and
the door
shut and we were able to lock it. And it was just like, these are our walls. This is our place. I kicked my shoes off and sat down. And I was just like, home.
I mean, at that point, we were homeless for 14 months. And after 14 months of not having a bathtub for our kids to have a bubble bath in or an oven to make cookies in or a Saturday to sleep in, I've almost forgotten what it's like to have our own place.
Right.
I'm just so ready to start making plans and doing things with you and as a family and living again. And I'm so glad that we get to do it together.
I want to thank you for being strong and amazing and working so hard for all of us so we could be whole again.
That was Charlotte and Nick, and now I want to ask them to come up and So Nick, I know everyone's going to want to know how you're doing these days. You look
I have my good days and bad days, but, you know, after spinal fusion surgery and 3 months of not being able to walk and rehab and physical therapy, you take each day one step at a time, literally, and you realize you are lucky to walk and appreciate it every day.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that. Now, Charlotte, I wanted to ask you, because this was not your first StoryCorps recording. 6 months prior to this recording, you had come and made a recording with Denise, who's actually here this evening. Hi, Denise. And when we heard your recording, we were so moved by your story, but we also wanted to know, well, how are this family doing now, and what's the update? And that's when we had the idea to have Charlotte and Nick come and make their recording. So can you talk about the difference that 6 months made from that first recording to the second one?
It was pretty much night and day. So when we did our first recording, it was Nick's birthday. And Nick was in the hospital still, and me and the boys were in shelter. So I didn't have anybody to do my interview with. So I was just like, give me anybody. Like, I don't know. I don't have anybody to talk to. And so Denise volunteered to do the interview. And it was wonderful to have somebody who didn't know me necessarily to talk about it, because I didn't say homeless for 7 of those 14 months that we were homeless. So once I started saying that word, I needed to talk about it. And for so long, when Nick was sick the first time, we were between places, or it wasn't a good time to come over, or all the 10,000 excuses I could think of. So finally, when I said I was homeless and asked for help, there was no way to stop. So having someone who didn't know me and being able to explain everything was really therapeutic. So then our interview with Nick was the day before Valentine's Day, so it was 6 months exactly.
Mm-hmm. And Charlotte, tell us something about your work situation right now. So you had a job change recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was working as an intern in the payroll department at the YWCA, and after we got housing, I found out about open positions at Mary's Place, which was the shelter that me and my boys had stayed at for 6 months. And I wanted to come back so much because it's such an amazing community and they're like my family. After going through all of this frightening experience, I'm not even sure if that encompasses it. I really wanted to come back and have an excuse to come back. And so when I came back as an employment coordinator, I was super excited to be there. So that's why I'm working at Mary's Place now.
So when you say employment coordinator, what does that involve?
I work with families and women in getting back to employment and however they envision that. So that's working on getting an ID, getting childcare, getting clothes, interview, the whole path to that. So it's really amazing to be back there.
It's incredible. And Nick, I know during the recording you had said something, or maybe afterwards, to me about how this was really, it had been an opportunity for the two of you to talk out some of the roller coaster past few months. Is that how you feel about that conversation looking back?
Yeah. For us, our relationship had gone through kind of a rocky patch. And I had taken some things for granted and maybe not realized just how special of a woman I had in my life. And when you lose your house and your health and you really have nothing to fall back on but your family, and you see who's there and who wants to be there and who works, it really opens your eyes and your heart. And you realize what you truly love and what you need to hold on to and not ever let go of. And I won't ever let go.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're at the end of our of our story section, but before we finish, I just wanted to acknowledge the other StoryCorps participants who are in the audience, and we have quite a few of them. We have Sherry and Franklin here. Please stand up so we can give you a round of applause. We have Dennis. Where's Dennis? Dennis Pullen. Mr. Pullen, stand up. Stand up, stand up. And then Jan. I don't see Jan. Where's Jan? Hi, Jan, at the back. Who else? Liz. Liz. Where's Liz? Oh, hi, Liz. I just want to thank all of them, and you're going to be able to hear their stories and others on KUOW over the next few weeks, so please listen out for that. And you can also listen at the Firesteel site and at the KUOW site. And what can I say? Thank you to all of you. Thank you so much. Would not have been, and none of this would have been possible. Thank you. Okay. So I'm going to welcome your host for part two, and we're so fortunate because tonight we have Bill Radke, who's here with us. As most people I'm sure know in this audience, Bill is a radio talk show host, a web video host, an author, a comedian, a columnist. He's hosted American Public Media's Marketplace Morning Report and co-hosted the radio show Weekend America, produced by American Public Media. And today he's heard as the host of KUOW's Morning News Magazine. And we're thrilled to have Bill with us tonight to lead us in a policy-based discussion that will kick off based on themes that you've heard from the three pieces that we just played. So please join me in welcoming Bill Radke. Thank you.
Thank you, Eve. Thank you, Nick and Charlotte and Lena and Raj and Lika and Lynette. Thank you for letting us tell your stories. If you're listening to StoryCorps in the morning and tearing up, then I probably am too, so I'm with you. 10 years ago this spring, King County made a very bold vow to end homelessness in 10 years. And, of course, that was an awfully complicated, ambitious mission. This spring, on the occasion of 10 years, we, KUOW, launched this series, reporting series, about homelessness. And it was titled No End in Sight, which may sound like kind of a pessimistic title, but it reflected what officials told us, which is that they had sort of shaped their goal from the end of homelessness to the mission of making homelessness rare and brief. So let's talk about that with Mark Putnam from the King County Committee to End Homelessness. Mark, welcome. Coming. Katara Jordan is with Columbia Legal Services, the Children and Youth Project there. Katara? Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. And Anna Marquis is with Building Changes, a Seattle nonprofit. Hi, Anna. Thank you for coming. So we just heard a few fantastic and powerful individual stories. I want to know, what do these stories we've heard tonight say about the bigger picture, the bigger issue of homelessness in this area that you want us to know about? Mark, can we start with you?
Yeah, thanks very much. This tonight's been very powerful. Coupled with a couple weeks ago, the stories at the Moth series was these two things I think are really, really important, and we get to hear from people directly about their experiences. I'll start, I guess, by talking about one of the stories that really resonated with Raj and Alina. Their story was one of a human connection, and I think there are a lot of those, thankfully, in our community. More than 1,000 people, around 1,000 people, at a given time in King County actually have the ticket to housing. They've been homeless. They can get housing. They have a housing subsidy. They have the ability to help pay for rent. they can't find a place to rent, or it's taking a long time for them to find rent. Luckily, there are people like Raj. There are about 2,000 other landlords over the past 8 years that have worked with the Landlord Liaison Project, and more that have worked with other service providers to provide those opportunities for stability for people like Alina and so many others in our community.
Katara, you and I were talking about how we're listening to Lika's story and talking about how many students, I think it was 30,000 students in Washington State are considered homeless. And you were telling me about the legal rights that students have that a lot of us don't know about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to thank Lika for sharing your story. And the reason why it's so powerful that she's sharing her story, as you mentioned, she's one of 32,494 students that have been identified as homeless. And that's a 92% increase in student homelessness since 2006-2007. Now, there is a federal program known as the McKinney-Vento Act, which does provide certain services and rights to students who are experiencing homelessness. One of the huge things is that it requires each school district to identify someone as a homeless liaison, and there are certain rights such as the ability to receive transportation to and from the school of origin. So what that means is the school that the student was attending at the time they became homeless, and let's say they have to find shelter somewhere else in another community, they have the right to receive transportation to and from the school of origin. McKinney-Vento is a great program, and it promotes education continuity, but education continuity and housing stability are not mutually exclusive. And I would actually argue that housing stability is crucial to educational continuity. It's almost impossible to have educational continuity without housing stability. And I just think, we need to, think of creative ways to make that happen for the thousands of homeless students and homeless youth who are trying to go to school each and every day.
You were telling me about how the idea of keeping students connected with their school is well-intentioned, but you went to Olympia to try to change it.
Yeah, absolutely. So my organization, we were working on a policy known as the Homeless Student Stability Act. And what that policy would have done is create two grant programs. The first grant program would have provided $500,000 to OSPI, which is our kind of equivalent of our State Board of Education, to kind of supplement the federal funding that they receive to implement the McKinney-Vento program. Our state receives $950,000 to implement McKinney-Vento, but we have 295 school districts, and as I mentioned before, over 30,000 students. So that money is only scratching the surface, maybe if we're lucky, going to 20 schools. And so what we're trying to do is say, hey, state, you need to invest in this population. If you want to see improvement in education outcomes, put money towards this. But also, we're realizing that if we can also increase housing and give schools the ability to help families they identify as homeless, get connecting with housing resources, that would be huge. And so the other grant program of the Homeless Student Stability Act is it would provide $500,000 to Commerce to try to implement pilot programs for school housing partnerships. And one of those partnerships exists at the King County Housing Authority, and they partnered with the Highline School District, and they housed five families, which was a total of 11 individuals, and they saved $80,000 in transportation costs. And so what we're saying is housing is a wise investment, and these are the policies that we need to implement to make sure that we are having, an effective, we're doing effective advocacy and effective outcomes for these students experiencing homelessness.
Anna Marquis, you were telling me about how big factors besides medical health are in medical health, and we're learning that.
Sure, yeah, I was just so struck by Nick and Charlotte's story, and, obviously no family should become homeless because they get sick. And so what's exciting is we're starting to see more recognition from healthcare systems about like you said, how sort of clinical care, that time you spend in the doctor's office, really only accounts for about 10% of what makes you healthy. And these factors outside of that, like the environment you live in, social factors, account for much more of that. So a lot of the work we do is trying to have better coordination between clinical healthcare systems and programs such as housing, employment, and these other needs that families have.
You want doctors to ask about what else is going on outside the body.
Right. So one really exciting program that's nationwide, but we have here locally, is called the Medical Legal Partnership. And so that's where civil legal attorneys work with doctors in clinics that serve low-income families, and they train them to really scratch beneath the surface a little more. So if they're treating asthma, they're taught to ask about, well, what's your living condition? Is there mold in the house? How can you prescribe someone medication for something like asthma if they don't have a refrigerator for, I don't actually know if asthma medicine is goes in the fridge, but there are many medications that go in the fridge, and it's a classic example of how medical systems might not be taking someone's social and environmental factors into play. So Medical Legal Partnership does that, and when those issues are surface, like maybe there's a eviction in process or foreclosure issues or educational issues, that partnership with the legal aid can work to quickly resolve those issues.
So what's striking me here tonight is how from doctors, lawyers, teachers, obviously, landlords, more and more of us are learning, oh, I'm involved in the issue of homelessness too, in different walks of life. So I'd like to ask, what can our audience, hundreds of people here tonight, what do you want them to go away and do in their own lives? Anybody?
Yeah, and maybe I can back out a little and answer. You started around the 10-year plan to end homelessness and where we are and come around to that. We, in 2005, set that ambitious goal along with cities and counties across the state, cities across the country. I think it was the right thing to do. Without that target, we wouldn't have housed and moved 40,000 people from homelessness to housing. It set an ambitious bar for us that we continue to strive to reach, and we are laser focused on still getting there. And I think what we've learned, among many things, but is that it's not just local government, it's not just the school district or the hospital. It's really the entire community that we need to be engaged in ending homelessness. So I think you identified a few ways. I'm always talking about landlords. I think that's the most important thing. People who are homeless need homes. People who are homeless experiencing homelessness often need jobs. So employers who are willing to give a chance to people maybe that have a criminal history that is barring them from finding housing and finding jobs. Really important things. If you're not an employer or a landlord, there's something you can do every day as you see somebody who's homeless. You can say hello to them, which is the slogan of this amazing Facebook group, Homeless in Seattle. And you can. There's always something you can do to give, make a human connection with people that makes their day better, reminds us all that we're human and can make that connection that puts them on the path to ending their homelessness.
Before we hear from Kantara and Anna on that, can I ask you about, you said the homeless need homes. It reminds me that on KUOW, we've talked about this initiative in Utah where they made a huge dent in homelessness by giving people who don't have homes, homes. What are the pros and cons of that approach in Seattle?
Yeah, it's
King County.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. There was a great clip on, Google that on John Stewart Daily Show.
Yeah.
It's a great, great clip. They actually, I don't say this because we had it right first or something, but the folks from Utah came to Seattle about 10, 12 years ago, met with people at Downtown Emergency Services Center and at other local providers that were doing permanent supportive housing, which is the model that they've really expanded in Utah. And they came and they learned and they went back and they did it better and bigger.
Critics call it bunks for drunks. You're just giving somebody a home. You know,
right.
Fox News said that's just creating parasites, et cetera.
Yep. And you'd think that Fox News would love it because it's actually cheaper to house somebody than not. So it costs the taxpayer more to not house somebody who's homeless than to house them because of emergency room costs and jail costs, shelter costs, the cost of being homeless. And obviously it's not humane, but there's actually the conservative argument there too that it's the wiser investment.
Katara or Anna, anybody else want to talk about what these good people can go away and do?
Well, I would say, I mean, I'm sure there are healthcare professionals in the audience. And so, like I said, it's so important to think about what's really going on in that person's life. And so you may be treating a medical issue, but it's really critical to make sure that that you know what's happening in their home life, that they can really adhere to whatever's being prescribed. So I'm thinking more holistically. And then also making sure that people truly have access to the care they need. So even just anyone in your life, you know, we're fortunate to live in Washington State, which has taken advantage of insurance expansion. So here in King County, about 200,000 people enrolled in health insurance, many for the first time in 2014. So that's like step one, you know, if you
under
know...
the Affordable Care Act.
That's right, under Obamacare. And so, you know, if you know someone who doesn't have insurance, you know, help them get online to WashingtonHealthPlanFinder.org. And get enrolled. They will likely qualify for something. And that's just step one. Once they have that and they have their cute little Apple Health card, there's always a phone number on the back. And so if they're not getting the care they need or they're having trouble navigating, you know, getting to these appointments, figuring out who they need to see, those companies are required to do what's called care coordination, to do that kind of legwork to help people get to the appointments they need.
Tara, anything to add?
Sure. So I think, one, you guys being here in this audience, learning and becoming more aware of kind of the scope of homelessness in our state is huge. I would also ask to push forward and learn about what organizations are doing in our community. Learn about building changes. Learn about the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance. Learn about the Housing Trust Fund. Learn about those things so you are a more informed advocate and you can reach out to our decision makers and say these things need to be adequately funded to help us, you know, make a dent towards ending homelessness. I know that there's a...
How can they learn about that stuff most efficiently?
A Google search. I mean, there's. Oh. I know there's people in the... Google Building Changes. Google Washington Low Income Housing Alliance. Google the Housing Trust Fund. I mean, when I started, you know, doing this work, that's what I had to do. I had to start from scratch because I didn't come with an experience of what homelessness was. I had to change, you know, as, you know, Miss Lynette, you know, spoke about in her story, you know, homelessness is broad, you know, and oftentimes, particularly for family homelessness and youth homelessness, they're kind of the hidden homelessness population. And when we know more, we're more informed and we can give decision makers, you know, concrete steps that they can take to really help us, you know, work towards, you know, solving this issue in our community.
Let's take some questions from our audience. And we're going to do that both here. We'll hand around a microphone. And also in the theater, the Overflow group there. Hi, theater. Please write down a question, and we'll if you haven't already, and we'll pass it over and choose some of your questions as well. Anybody want to start us off? Gentleman right here. Hand it down. Thank you.
Okay, hi. I work in a homeless shelter in Everett. I'm a retired middle school principal, private school.
Middle school principal?
Yeah, and I'm retired, well, sort of. I right now work at, it's called the Interfaith Family Shelter in Everett, and I'm the children's advocate there. I run the kids program. I think I now have about 28 kids that I, well, try to take care of. And I've been there for 5 years, and the numbers increase every single year. It's growth. And I'm seeing now more of the kids in the age range from, you know, day one through 14. And the biggest group I have right now, I think it's between two and 4 years of age. Okay. And, you know, so what am I doing in terms of preventing homelessness? I don't think I'm doing bugger all, as they say in the old country. Seriously. So I walk into my office, and they come running up to me, and they come into my office, they take my office apart. I help get them health insurance, help the families get health insurance. I talk with the teachers, I meet with the teachers, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, I shut my office door, get in my car, go to my nice little house in Snohomish. And on the way, I say, boy, you've done nothing to stop homelessness. I walk into my office the following day. Same kids come up to me, grab my legs. Hi, Mr. Peep. You know, and I kids around with them, and it goes on and on and on. But
do you have a question for our panel?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I still have not stopped homelessness. So what's the solution? What's part of the solution? I have to go back to day one. That is, I have to start thinking in terms of some or the other, I've got to give this kid skills not to be homeless.
Who wants to take that? What's the solution? That's a big one.
Yeah, I can start. I think what you're getting at is that we can have really good programs. We can we talked about permanent supportive housing as a solution, giving people homes, rental assistance programs, employment programs. Those are all really good things. There's a capacity issue, however, that so many people are becoming homeless. So each year in King County, about 50% of the people that experience homelessness have not been homeless before. So it's a huge number of newly homeless people. So there's a systemic issue. And I think we don't like to talk about these things sometimes because they're so big and there are some tangible solutions right in front of us. But the big ones are, more affordable housing, income equality, safety net services. We talk about what the state can do around mental health funding and schools. All those things that start when kids are young, before they're living in poverty and they've become homeless.
Anna, I remember someone from your nonprofit, Building Changes, telling us on KUOW about how you'd be surprised how often the best solution is a small solution, not a big one, but giving someone a little help instead of a lot of help with the goal of ending homelessness immediately, that's job one, not necessarily the bigger, overwhelming picture. Is that right?
Well, some of it comes down to sort of not taking a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, so in the past, a lot of traditional programs had a set maybe time limit for housing or a set level of service that they gave everyone. And so what we've found is sometimes you can stretch dollars farther by using an approach we call progressive engagement. So it's kind of starting with the minimum amount of services that family needs at that time so that you have resources for other families. You know, and you can do more. It's kind of like we use the analogy in cooking, like, use a little bit of salt because you can always put more in, but you can't take it out once it's there.
Any other questions? I saw this lady first.
Oh, I'm wondering if there are particular organizations that you might suggest that we can donate money to.
Good question. Who should we give money to? Who's first?
Have we mentioned the back of your program also has a list of organizations and 10 things you can do?
Yes, good.
That's
point.
That's a tough one because there are so many good organizations.
But are there ways for someone who has a particular interest to go and decide what's the best way for them to get involved? Go ahead. Or any other? Katara.
If individuals are interested in working towards ending student homelessness, one of the huge things, and I think the Seattle Times just chronicled actually a school in the Tukwila School District that has, created food banks, clothing banks. They're providing, resources to families, partnering up with local school districts and saying, what do you need? What can I donate? How can I volunteer? Many of you may be involved in other organizations like the Rotary Club or other, organizations that do volunteer work in the community. Really connecting with the school district would be huge. So that's one way.
This was next in line. She has the microphone, yes.
Hi, my name's Carrie Campbell. I work for an organization called Friends of Youth. We help homeless kids between the ages of anywhere from 7 to 25. And I'm wondering about the getting the word out there. Is there a plan to change the conversation outside of all of us who are already sort of on board? Because I feel like you touched on it earlier about, I have kids of my own, and one of my daughter's friends said in the car, well, they had a program on the news that said that, some people that are homeless, they just want to be homeless. And so there's a group of people that just think that homeless people are either choosing it or they aren't doing enough to, right, there's all of that. And I'm wondering if we can't have some kind of campaign that starts getting these real faces out there. And then my second thing is, I like the idea of not calling it ending homelessness anymore, because just I see that we may end homelessness for one, but the next person's coming up. There's so many issues, you know, that cause these unfortunate situations. Anyway,
can't. On the first point, sometimes do-gooders are not good marketers, and it would be better if they were. Are there, yeah, any new, what's, I always like to hear what's working. Any new approaches you're hearing about when it comes to telling the story in a way that reaches people who aren't the true believers already?
Have you heard of StoryCorps?
Yes.
No, I think you know, these types of events certainly get the word out, and I think, you know, whenever someone like KUOW can cover the issue the way you did in March and continue to cover it, I think is really important. I mentioned you asked what's working. I think I mentioned the Homeless in Seattle Facebook page, which has 16,000 followers. You know, a lot more people in our region to join that, but it really does connect the story and the face and the human that's experiencing homelessness with people in the community, shares that story, and sometimes is able to make connections to help that person. The Committee to End Homelessness has also identified that need that you spoke of, a broader public awareness campaign. We are launching a new strategic plan this summer. That's a key strategy. And so we hope to expand, build on successful efforts like Homeless in Seattle and take it even larger in our community.
Here's a question from the theater. We say no capacity for housing, yet new buildings on every block in our downtown area. Is there any thought to requiring at least 5% affordable housing in all developments with 15 or more units, mixed housing?
Yes, there is. There have been, you know, many efforts, and different cities across King County, across the region, have done that. We have a housing levy, which is up for renewal next year, which provides an incredibly important resource for developing affordable housing. And currently in the city of Seattle, Mayor Murray's commissioned a housing affordability and livability agenda task force that's currently meeting. Next month we'll be coming out with recommendations, and the mayor's challenged them to come up with a plan to build 20,000 affordable units over the next 10 years. So that's a huge step in the right direction.
You'll be hearing a lot about that on a certain radio station, I promise. Any other comments before we take another question? Okay. Moving on, and let me know if I'm, where are we on time? 6:05? Supposed to be wrapping up about now? I get lost in the, I just want to know more.
We have plenty of time. We have till 7:30.
Till 7:30, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so I work at Mary's Place. I currently did the housing.
Mary's Place is a shelter in Seattle.
Yes. And so I was doing the housing for the last 4 years. So it's not, the way to end homelessness is not just to give somebody a house, because that doesn't mean they're going to sustain it. You've got to meet everybody where they're at. Say, supportive permanent housing is perfect, because there are families that are dealing with other issues. They might be able to pay the rent, but if they don't get those underlying issues, mental health, maybe there's addiction issues, getting to that hard stuff is really important too, or you're going to see chronic homelessness with some of these kids, and it happens every single day. But I think the way that Utah started, that supportive permanent housing is a really good start. And we have a lot of families that are immigrating to here, especially Washington State, refugees that don't even know the language, that are homeless. And you're giving them rapid rehousing isn't going to help them if they can't even speak English. So addressing those that don't even know the language, that are just getting used to being here also.
So Anna, how does that square with your approach of less is more?
Well, I think it's not
more is more.
I think it depends on the family, is what we would say. So you're talking about families who may have much more complex needs, and there are permanent supportive housing for families models across the state. Our organization has funded about 19 of those programs across the state to address exactly what you're talking about, that some families who really have complex needs and may have been involved in child welfare systems, may have both physical health disabilities and behavioral health disabilities, they may need a little bit more support to access what they need and a little more time.
More questions? I see you'll be, maybe we can make her next. I see a microphone over here. Yes.
So my question is, you said there's a levy coming up. And my question is, of that, those homes that are going to be advocated for those who are homeless, how much of those percentage will be devoted to those who are homeless and have a physical disability? You know, somebody who has a walker or somebody who is blind or something like that. And my other thing is that I found what really works for me. When I was homeless, I really reached out to other case managers. I went to other organizations, and I actually created a database for myself. And I hand those out to people that I know. Nowadays, people say, hey, I'm homeless now. Can you tell me what's available and stuff? So I find that peer advocacy works for that, too.
Yeah, is there a one sheet online that we can print and hand to people? Just here's some of what you need to know. That's probably been done.
Yeah, there are a lot of different resources, different places to go. Really depends on your circumstances. If you're experiencing homelessness, we've developed a approach to finding that housing and applying through a single assessment. And it depends on your circumstances, your eligibility for different programs. We've tried to simplify that. So there's different ways to access housing. I think what she's speaking to as far as housing for people with disabilities, it's incredibly important. Permanent supportive housing for people with disabilities is often the solution. Sometimes it's just affordable housing. Just need the ability to pay rent and have accessible units. I can't answer specifically how the levy is going to address that. That's to be determined. But I think I believe there are strong advocates looking, thinking about the same populations you are.
Yeah. Does she need to rattle somebody's cage on that issue, or is that already being represented?
I think that at the City of Seattle, that's the place to go right now. If you're a City of Seattle resident, your mayor and your council would love to hear from you, I'm sure.
Yes, ma'am.
So one thing I'm really struck by is the significant increase in the number of homeless over the past 10 years instead of the decrease. And so what that says to me is that there, while you may be taking care of some, there's still a lot coming in that it's sort of what are the safety nets? What are the programs that might help those that are on the verge of homelessness to prevent them from becoming homeless so that, if they're right on the cusp, how do you get them before they're actually homeless?
I can answer that too. I think that's, it's incredibly important. We, with so many people becoming homeless, how do we stop that? I think, I talked about affordable housing as well as prevention. We've talked about prevention and it all adds up, So I think the state has its part to play as far as funding mental health services. Washington State is 47th out of 50 states in access to psychiatric beds. So that impacts, so we see people who are mentally ill that don't have a place to go when they're having an episode, and they can't, they don't have a place to call home. I think, as far as prevention strategies locally, what King County is trying to do this year, I'll talk about another levy, is pass the Best Starts for Kids levy, which is really going to really birth, through childhood, and really bringing strategies that help the family, help the child, and prevent the costs that come later when you don't provide health care, when you don't provide education, when you don't provide housing.
That's going to King County voters, right?
It is.
Is that this fall?
Mm-hmm.
Odds it'll pass?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Any more questions?
Can I speak to her question a bit as well? I know in the advocacy that we're doing related to student homelessness, one of the things we're finding is that schools are often the first place where a family is identified as homeless. And so it's kind of the gateway to other services. So that's why it's so important, you know. I know that schools are just one system, and I'm not saying that, you know, there should be a silo, but that's why it's so important for teachers to be trained, for us to have well-funded staff who are who know how to identify students who are experiencing homelessness, because it's really one way that we, because the, and I won't go down the rabbit hole, but the definition of homelessness for students is broad, and so in many ways we're focusing on preventing homelessness, for preventing kind of being out on the streets versus living in a doubled up situation. And so I think schools could really play a big part of that. So.
Yeah, I'm blinded now by the beautiful sun. Yes.
This may be a question for the StoryCorps folks, but as a rapid rehousing provider, I would love to use that recording of Raj and Elena as a landlord recruitment tool. Can I do that?
Yeah, sure, Eve.
Yes.
Thank you.
Permission granted.
And while I'm up here, can I just give a shout out to Zanita, who's sitting here right in front of me, who was also one of our amazing storytellers, whose story is going to be airing on KUOW, and I didn't mention before. Zanita, you are awesome.
Is this a good time for me to hand it over to Barry? Oh, follow-up question.
I'm just wondering if the StoryCorps stuff is going to be used and or given to the decision makers that we're talking about and the policy people who are responsible for putting these dollars into these incredible programs. Is there any targeted effort for sort of the StoryCorps campaign to go to those individuals?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer. Is Catherine here? Catherine? Erin and Denise, can I hand the mic to you? Okay, this is Erin from YWCA.
Hi, I am so excited to tell you where to find tons of these stories so you can do just that. So the YWCA and our Firestill Advocacy Network was one of the partners in making all of this happen. And we predicted that this question would come up and people would want to know where this collection is and how to use it. So if you have this sheet, on the back, number 5 says, learn about how policy affects families in our community. Go visit Firestill, where you can hear more stories from the Finding Our Way project. So if you go to that website, there is a button called StoryCorps. And if you click on that, you'll be able to access, I think it's like 20 edited stories. And if you represent a nonprofit or a university, maybe you're a student and you want access to the full archive, that includes the full 40-minute raw unedited stories and the transcribed audio as well, you can request access. And you can even search the stories by specific topic. So whether it's domestic violence, student homelessness, you can search that way. And we've also tagged all of these stories by legislative district. Because who do legislators want to hear from? Voters and people who live in their constituents. And so the people who told their stories, who have experienced homelessness, they are voters, they are constituents, and those of us who may not have experienced it ourselves or did not share our voice with this project, we are still voters, and we can send these specific stories to our legislators, and we make it easy for you to do. So visit the website.
There's a lot of parents of a lot of those students who are constituents that might be interested.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Final words before we turn it over to Barry? What's the... Oh, sorry, another question. How about, can this be the last question?
I guess I'm
I think it's time. Pardon? Oh, Nick, okay. And then to you, Nick. Yes, last question.
Just real quick, I run an organization that supports families with children with developmental disabilities. And Nick and Charlotte's story really resonated with me because a lot of our families have children who spend long periods of time in the hospital with surgeries, et cetera. And I have come to the realization here tonight that I have no idea how to support any of our families who might be experiencing homelessness and would like to know if there are resources out there specifically for families who have children with developmental disabilities, so things like Down syndrome or autism that might make staying in a shelter a little more difficult. What types of resources are out there? And we work with families both in King and Snohomish County.
Go ahead.
I'd love to follow up with you afterward. I'm not aware of anything, you know, like a housing-specific program for families with a child with a developmental disability. I do know there's some housing vouchers available for those, and I can connect you with the person who runs that program. But it definitely speaks to the larger need to have better coordination between the DD programs and housing programs.
I was going to say there are some housing programs for families with developmental disabilities, and they are available through DSHS and through King County, and I can follow up with you too.
Nick?
I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you to our sponsors that let us all get here tonight, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, StoryCorps, and everybody else. I also wanted to say word of mouth. Everybody that's here, you are a key to help stopping the situations that everybody in this front row has been in. Tell your friends, tell your families, let them know what you've seen tonight. Tell them about the websites. Just inform. Also, don't be afraid to volunteer, because that is a huge step. When Charlotte and I were in our shelter and families would come and give their time to bring a meal and play with the kids, and we would have 5 minutes to ourselves to be adults and alone with our own thoughts, and to get away for a few minutes from our children, who we love dearly but need a break from, that is an amazing relief, and we thank you guys when you do that. So the more volunteering that you do, that is just as great a help as a dollar that you give. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Will you please also thank Mark and Katara and Anna for being with us? Thank you. Thank you all. I, too, want to thank StoryCorps. Somebody told me, I've heard it more than once, that StoryCorps is a nice break from the news. But StoryCorps, and I agree, but StoryCorps also is the news, because these people are telling you what's going on in our society right now. And so I want to thank StoryCorps for bringing us the news. And I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank the Gates Foundation for understanding the power of story, how central story is to improving the human condition, which is their great mission. So thank you to them as well. And I want to turn to Barry Mitzman from Seattle University's Project on Family Homelessness. Good to see you again, Barry.
Thank you, Bill. And please join me in thanking Bill Radke, our capable moderator this evening. And our panelists, Mark Putnam, Kadara Jordan, and Anna Markey. Thank you all for your participation tonight. I am Barry Mitzman. I teach strategic communications at Seattle University and also direct the university's Project on Family Homelessness, which was involved in helping to coordinate the StoryCorps project here on the ground and help put on this event tonight. And I just want to thank a few people by way of closing. In addition to Bill at KOW, I'd like to recognize Caroline Dodge and Arvid Hokanson, the producers at KOW, who have helped us by co-sponsoring this event tonight and by airing the stories, which you should continue to listen to KOW constantly, 24 hours a day, to catch every broadcast of the segments on KOW. I want to thank the StoryCorps team, which has done remarkable work in helping to bring forth
the stories, the experiences, bringing alive the experiences of people who've experienced homelessness in our community. Michelle Bova, Eve Claxton, and Abby Lesnick, particularly. Please, a round of applause. And all of the service providers and advocates who've helped us find families and engage with them and do the recordings, the families that you've heard from tonight, and many more. Nearly 200 people participated in this Finding Our Way StoryCorps project here in the Puget Sound region, recording 40 minutes of stories about their experiences, being willing to share those, having the courage to share those, to come forward so that all of us can better understand what they're dealing with, what our community is dealing with, and what we need to do. Please join me in thanking them for their participation. Close to home, I mentioned that our project on family homelessness coordinated the work of StoryCorps, helped coordinate the work of StoryCorps here on the ground and prepare the way. And I would be negligent in the extreme if I didn't recognize the coordinator, the day-to-day manager of our project, Catherine Heinrichsen, who's here somewhere. And finally, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which supports our project at Seattle University, a lot of other efforts in our community to reduce family homelessness. And I particularly want to single out the program officers, Colin Min and David Ortheimer, who've demonstrated tremendous courage and willingness to take risks, to find creative ways to help people understand, to help people care in all the ways that you experienced tonight and many others over the years. It's tremendous work. It's tremendously important work, and they deserve your applause. Now, finally, I was supposed to tell you what to do, but actually Nick has done it very well and much better than I could have possibly done. But just to reiterate some of the things he said, you want to know what to do? Share these stories. Share the stories that are on the YWCA website that Aaron told you about. Share the stories that are airing on KOW and are up on the KOW website in a StoryCorps Seattle Homeless page. Share them with your neighbors. Share them with your friends. Even better, share them with your Facebook friends. Get the word out. Even if you're already active and very involved and aware of these issues in our community, it's easy to underestimate how many people don't know, don't understand, have no idea what's going on out there. Tell them. Use these stories to tell them. Share them. Get the word out. Make ending homelessness a viral phenomenon. We can do it. We can do it in our community. Take action. Tell five people. Ask them to tell five people. It can happen. Volunteer. You've heard about some volunteer opportunities. There's a list of organizations on the back of your program that would welcome your help, your participation, your goodwill, and yes, your money too, to help advance this cause, this tremendously important cause. And there are lots of other actions you can take. They're listed also in your program. Do something that feels right to you, that fits with your circumstances, that engages your talents and your skills, but do something. It's important to understand. It's important to appreciate. If you're like me, you've heard a lot here tonight that's disturbing. You've heard a lot that's heartening. We've learned things, but if we don't act, nothing happens. So take the next step. Get involved. Take that next step. And finally, there are evaluations of this event tonight on your chairs, and the foundation would very much appreciate hearing from you about what you think of what you heard tonight, about what this event meant to you. It's important in sustaining support for these programs within the foundation and beyond. So please give us your thoughts. Share what you know. Thank you all for being here tonight. Really appreciate your participation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It helps other people find us. This StoryCorps Finding Our Way event took place on May 19th, 2015, at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitor Center. Project sponsors included the YWCAs of Seattle, King, and Snohomish counties, Catholic Community Services of Tacoma, and Seattle University's Center for Strategic Communications. Thanks again to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.